Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, it's John Williams, and good morning. Welcome to the John Williams Show. We're here weekdays from 9 to noon. On Saturdays, I'm on sometime, I don't even know when, but I'm on Saturdays in the afternoon. I get preempted a lot, what with there being White Sox baseball coming up and then basketball and football games. But you hear me sometimes on Saturdays. And on social media, it's WGN King John. I, on my Facebook page, WGN King John on Facebook, ask you to tell me what is the one unassailable truth that we've learned from the latest airline viral video. The guy punching the seat of the woman during a flight because she had reclined. He did ask her to move it forward. She did briefly, but then put it back after she felt that he had eaten his meal. She said she has fused vertebrae and it's uncomfortable for her to sit forward. She has to lean back. Why do I have trouble believing that? That is so unfair of me. Denise said this on Facebook. She said, why don't they just drug all of us, load us horizontally on racks, and then wheel the racks onto the plane? Please see the Seinfeld episode where Kramer rents out the drawers of his dresser to tourists.
Yep.
I don't know that episode.
Yeah, that's when the hot tub overheated and actually got them stuck in the drawers.
Oh, that was hilarious. Yeah. I do remember that one.
They just drugged us all and put us on racks and just wheeled us in like so much cargo. And then they just wake us up, Mr. Mazur. Ms. Vandeveld, you're there.
You're here.
Oh, I'm in Phoenix. Hooray. Oh, that wasn't so bad.
That would work great for long flights.
Why don't they just put every seat like they do in the emergency rows? You can't lean back to the emergency row. Just don't give them the option.
Andy, I think that's the truth that we all came up with. Everybody's got a team on was he bad, was she bad. Yeah. But the airlines, I think we all agree, are miserable because they're just squeezing the last dollar of profit. And you know what they do on a lot of flights? I mean, if you travel for a long time, here's what they do. It doesn't matter when they put you on the plane. You get up in the air, they come down with a drink cart, they close the window shades, and they put you to bed now. Mm-hmm. They just try and get you just drunk enough that you go to sleep, and then hopefully you won't be a problem. It's I like to have the window open. I like the light. I like to look out the window. Sir, would you please roll that down? We're trying to keep the cabin quiet and dark. All right, fine. I do that. But I don't go ballistic and start pounding the seat in front of me. We'll talk more about this in a little bit. There was a PBS special on the other night. I don't know if you saw it. It's called Dog Tales, T-A-L-E-S, and it's about... It has one fundamental question that it gets to. You learn a lot, but it is this. Does your dog wag its tail? Does your dog love you because it loves you or because you buy the chicken? Why does your dog love you? And is that real love or is it just they associate you with sustenance, treats, and food? So what is it? They did a really fascinating experiment to get to the bottom of this. Brenda and I have this running conversation joke about Daisy loves Brenda. Oh, Brenda says, Daisy doesn't love me. She just knows I'm the one that feeds her. I said, oh, I'm not sure. They answered that question on this PBS special the other night. The answer in a minute. A text is poured in. Hey, John, can you talk about how the CTA crime is so bad today? It draws more attention to how unsafe it is. I think that's all I talk about lately. And I'm going to my dog story in a second. But the problem I have with talking about CTA crime is the reminder that as many rides are taken on the CTA system every day as there are people in Philadelphia. Imagine all of Philadelphia getting on our trains. If there is a crime in Philadelphia, if there's five crimes in Philadelphia, today, you don't go, oh my God, we can't go to Philadelphia. But we sure get upset when a musician is knifed on an L platform or somebody else is mugged. It's terrible. And there is a feeling of hopelessness to it. So I have trouble sort of balancing those two. How bad or unsafe is the CTA relative to the total numbers? But I ride that red line every day. LF does too. A lot of us here do every single day. We're CTA people. We work downtown Chicago. And we love it and we get frustrated by it. And I can't put my finger on how unsafe it is. I do think in reporting these stories, we don't offer enough perspective on these stories. And that's the challenge for you, the listener, and me, the talker. So on Channel 11, they had this show. It's called Dog Tales. And they said, how much does your dog really love you? In fact, it was brought to my attention because one of our listeners knows of one of the women that was featured in the special. She's a professor at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. I used to live on that campus, SIUE. And she was kind of an expert on the relationship that hunters have with their dogs. They did an interesting experiment. They said, is a wolf, from which all dogs are extracted, smarter than the domesticated animals that we have now, right? I mean, we've bred dogs and trained dogs. We have breeds that seem to be smarter than others, and they can do all of these spectacular tasks. Have we made dogs smarter over the years because of specialization, or were they always that smart? They said, well, wolves today have the same DNA as wolves back then, and that's where all dogs came from. So then they took some wolves in the wild that they'd captured and some regular dogs, and they said, let's see if one batch of dogs or wolves is more trainable, is smarter than the other. They found out they're about the same, that the wolf can learn just as well as your cockapoo. So the point was that all along, dogs or wolves have had this sort of latent ability to be great companions to mankind, but we just never tapped it until the last 100 or 200 years or 300 years, whatever. There's stories that go way back when the dogs were helping hunters, but only now do we really realize their total potential, and so that's kind of cool. But does the dog wag its tail and greet you because he's thinking, we're going to get some food out of this, or does the dog do it because it loves you? What's your guess?
Well, I'm not a dog owner, but my parents own a dog. And obviously, I don't live with them, but when I come to see the dog is very happy to see me and wags the tail. And
you, the human, and they don't think you are going to give them food?
No, because once in a while, early in this dog's life, I did take care of him for a little while. But, you know, I just think it's kind of a thing where he gets excited when pretty much anybody comes to the door, whether it be me or somebody else.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's the way Daisy is. Yeah. And I think Daisy, our rescue, Dizzy, Dappled, Dachshund Daisy, she's this long white wiener dog with brown and black splotches. I should post another picture of her. She's an unusual and delightful looking little doggy. When the doorbell rings, she's like, hot damn, yeah, let's go, party time. The door opens up. If I'm there, she goes, oh, geez. She's never happy to see me. But if you walked in, or especially if a female walked in.
Oh, really?
If an animated female walks in, if my daughter-in-law walks in, when Nikki comes in, she goes, hi, Daisy. And Daisy just about does a back handspring. Daisy's dancing a dance. I'm so happy for Daisy that she has other people in her life besides me. The special concluded that the dog's affection for us really is attuned to us. You, the owner, that dog knows you and likes you, and it's not that you give it food. They put the dog in one of those MRI machines where you go inside the tube and they hit you with magnetic rays, and then they see if your brain is damaged or whatever. So they got a dog in there. They put dogs in there. It's amazing that the dog was able to sit there, right? And then they show the dog some food. And they can do the brain scan, and you see the dopamine firing off in the brain. And they have all of these color areas on the brain that shows that the brain's being activated. Happy dog, you can see in the brain. Food. Then they show the dog a toy that is associated with the owner. And they trained the dog to know that whenever it sees the toy, the owner is going to give it a hug. So now he sees the toy and he goes, oh my gosh, my owner. And the brain lights up like a Christmas tree. The dog is much more happy, if you're judging it by the brain scan, to see the owner than to get the food. The conclusion is that the dog really likes you, has affection for you. And I don't think anybody listening to that with a dog would argue that, but I think we've also kind of had that in the back of our mind. We've wondered.
I always ask the question of my dad, I wonder what he's thinking.
Oh, yeah. You
know? And my dad's like, we don't want to know.
There are moments when I have Edward Rover Murrow, and I'll be playing
with him. Wait a minute. I'm sorry.
Couch.
How do I not know that your dog is named Edward
Rover Murrow?
I just want to live with that for a second. Yeah. That is so fantastic, Steve.
It's because he talks to me all the time. So he's a talker.
Okay.
But there's times where we would be snuggling on the couch or in bed or wherever where there's no food anywhere nearby. And I can see by the way his face looks and the way his tail wags that he's genuinely in love and happy to be there as I scratch his belly or do whatever. So I kind of knew that the results would come out that way.
I've felt that we tend to, what is it, anthropomorphize. We tend to give the dogs human traits that reflect ours or reflect favorably on us, and it's not really the dog. The dog really doesn't love you. It's just your thigh is there, and they thought they'd sit it there. It's not like they want to snuggle up to you. But the more you think about it, and this show is pretty compelling.
And, you know, they have traits because my mom had had surgery last summer or last spring. And the dog would not leave her side when she came back from the hospital. Because
oh, really?
He just wanted to make sure she was okay. He was basically guarding her leg from everybody that would come around it.
Yeah. Well, if I give Brenda a hug or if we dance, sometimes a song will come on. And as you know, I'm a talented ballroom dancer, having participated like Mary Vandeveld did in Dancing with the Stars in Chicago. I didn't win, but that's because one of the other dancers, I'm on a tangent now, but he was a former NFL player, and during his dance, he took his shirt off. Oh. So I can't compete with that.
Plus, he probably raised more money.
Yeah, he was. I thought I was a bit of a fan favorite because, well, anyway, we digress.
Right.
So where was I?
So you were dancing, and then Daisy the dog was
watching
you.
Daisy doesn't like it.
Yeah. Oh.
Daisy jealousy. Does not. Yeah. I think she thinks that something bad is happening to Brenda. I think that's a sign of the dog's appreciation or affection. Steve, if you and I were dancing, would Edward Rover Murrow come up and sort of take offense, say, hey, wait a minute, be careful with Steve Grzanich here. He's my guy.
No, I don't think he would take offense, but he would try to join in.
He would report.
Yeah, he would want to join in.
See, my grand dog only likes me because I take the dog for a walk or a run.
Yeah.
So when I never feed the dog when we're babysitting for him, but when he sees me like put my shoes on, he knows that I'm going to take him for a walk. Then he loves me.
Yeah.
But that's the only time.
Hey, Ed, you're on WGN Radio. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Hey, what's up?
Did you see the picture, the video of the dog? The woman just came back from space. She was in space for about 328 days.
No.
Well, the dog went wild when she saw the woman.
Oh, really?
Add to that, someone just texted in from the 708 area code saying, hi, King Jong and everyone. I think when Christina Koch came back from the International Space Station, after nearly a year in space, her dog knew her, Sue. Yeah.
I saw that. That was amazing. Yeah. This dog was going crazy.
You know, it reminds me of those videos where these servicemen and women come back from overseas after a tour of duty, and the dog hasn't been there for a long time, and the dogs just flip out, right? Right, Ed?
Right. Mm-hmm. So, the dogs know. I think they're friendly.
Yeah, I appreciate the phone call. Yeah, that's a good observation. I haven't seen that, but I'll. The other set of videos that is remarkable to me right now, you see a lot of these, is one species of animal befriending another one. You know, a dog nurtures a deer or a tiger. And, you know, a rabbit or something. I mean, it's pretty... I don't know that I've seen the tiger-rabbit one.
And the video that was just last week of the fox and was it the skunk that were together, right?
Yeah.
Going, playing around together and hunting together.
I don't understand what's... You want to know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
If the dog goes, this is pretty cool, I'll help out a deer. Or if the dog's confused, I don't know, but it's nice to see. That PBS special, I think you can still watch online, is called Dog Tales, and it premiered February 12th. It's 9:30. This is WGN. You want another feel-good story? How about $400,000 from the LeBron James All-Star basketball team in the NBA All-Star game in Chicago this weekend going to a local arts initiative? And I didn't know anything about this. And when those people rushed onto the floor with the Team LeBron thing, I thought those were just people that were given shirts. But that was the student, faculty, and staff of this school. Mm-hmm. The guy that's in charge of that's going to tell us about that after 10 o'clock.
My dad had called in and wanted to tell Barry Manilow the whole story, which was awesome. Actually, my name was supposed to be Beth Ann. My mom had it all figured out. And when my dad was on the way to the hospital and heard Barry's song, Mandy, he switched it up a bit. And my mom was, like, just exhausted. She's like, sure, do whatever you want. And so I was not a Beth, and I wasn't a Mandy. My name is Bendy.
Check. I love the street cafe, I'm on a street team. I love Meryl Streep in the flick, One True Thing. I love traffic, I love the colors, yellow and green. I like talk radio when they talk about things. Let's talk about things.
Mandy was on our show yesterday, and her dad, Bob, had called earlier in the month when Barry Manilow was on our show. So Barry Manilow's on the show. A guy named Bob calls in to say hi to Barry and said that he had named his daughter after Barry's song Mandy, but he misheard the song on the radio and named her Mendy, M-E-N-D-Y. So we found Mendy, and she said, yeah, literally in the car on the way to the hospital, they had all picked out the name. It was Beth Ann or Beth Ann, probably Beth Ann, they were going to name her. And then the dad, because this is what dads do, they go, hey, that's a good song. We'll name her Mandy. But he thought it was Mendy. So the daughter's name today is Mendy rather than Mandy. We got a flood of people's text messages after that saying, here's how I got my name, or here's how we named our dog or cat. Nobody texted in with Edward Rover Murrow, however. Or is that the name of your dog, Steve Rosanich?
Yes, Edward Rover Murrow. And I'm registered with the AKC, the American Kennel Club, so I don't think anybody else can steal it.
Oh, is that how that works?
Yeah, yeah. Because when I bought Murrow as a puppy, as a full-blooded dog, you register them with the AKC.
Ah.
And that's you have to pick three names to do that. So,
by the way, yesterday at this time, I played for you a little bit of the song Moon River by Andy Williams. Mary will remember this conversation. They had played it at a sing-along before the movie Casablanca over the weekend. Brenda and I went to the Music Box Theater. So they're doing a sing-along, and we all sang Moon River. And I was reminded of how lovely the lyrics were. I looked them up, and the first option that came up was the Frank Ocean version of it. I sampled that, and it was met with wide derision here on the show. But I'm in that Frank Ocean rabbit hole now, Mary.
Oh, no.
Okay, so this is the song that maybe Frank Ocean is best known for and I think is really, really good.
Start my day up on the roof.
Super Rich Kids.
There's nothing like this type of view. Point the clicker at the tube.
I'll stop working for Frank here in a minute, but
I prefer expensive news.
I thought maybe you should know this guy's out there.
New girl, new ice, new glass, new vibes, good
times. His voice is beautiful. Never heard this song.
Good times,
this conversation touched me yesterday, John. I actually added that song of his version of Moon River to my Spotify playlist.
Amazing. We'll both be high. The help don't stare. They just walk by. They must don't care. A million, one, a million, two.
It goes on like that. Eventually, he starts to sing about super rich kids, and then he gives you the details about super rich kids. And I could listen to that song 10 times in a row and be happy on the 10th as I was on the first. 942, Frank Ocean. By the way, so dog love. Ed goes first. You're on WGN. Hi, Ed. What can we do for you? Good morning.
Hey, how you doing, John?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I'm a guy that never thought to have a dog. My wife grew up with dogs. I did not grow up with dogs. And 3 years ago, we got our first dog. My family went to the pet store, decided not to get the dog there, to get a fish, actually. They went to the pet store to get a fish.
I've been to this movie.
This was 3 years ago, like I said. And a year ago, I never quite thought that the dog loved me. So my family was on vacation. It was my job to watch the dog. I took a vacation just to watch the dog. I didn't want to throw it to my in-laws or anybody else. And usually I take my dog on a walk in the afternoon or on a bike ride in the afternoon. But I decided to go out in the morning. And I'm riding my bike. He's pulling me along on my left hand. And we're about a block away from home. And what happens? A rabbit shoots out in front of me. Nike chases him, cuts me off. I fall down and break my thumb. He's gone. And usually when you let Nike go by mistake, you got to chase him all over the neighborhood to get him back home. And that's what I was thinking. I'm on the ground holding my thumb. I'm in pain. I'm like, great, I got to go chase my dog down. I look up, and here comes Nike behind the house. His head is down, between his shoulders. And to me, he looked like he knew he was in trouble. And then he came right up to me, and he just sat down on my lap and waited for me to calm down and, you know, fix myself. And then we got up and walked home. That's the first time I realized that my dog loved me. He knew I was hurt. He came back. He sat next to me.
If a dog could say, dude, my bad, that's
that
how
would
a dog
be the time Nike would say it.
What kind of dog is Nike?
You know what? I don't know. I'm sorry. He is a rescue dog.
Sounds fast.
He's about 34 pounds.
Yeah.
He's black and white. Appropriate name, because Nike, we're all athletic in our family. And Nike is an athletic game, athletic shoe company, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he was a puppy, he would just run everywhere.
Nike.
According
what a
great to my
name.
Wife, we got very lucky with him, because I always thought a dog, you know, when he wanted to go to the bathroom, he'd just go through the door. And then you let him out. Our dog did that, but she said most dogs don't do that. Most dogs will pee all over the house. Our dog never did that. When he was little, he just went to the door, and we let him out, and he did his thing and came back out. So we were very lucky with Nike.
You sure are. Hey, you have a good day. Our best to you and Nike and the whole family, Ed.
Thanks, John, and keep the good work up.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Love the name, too.
I don't think I'd ever ride a bike with a dog named Nike. I would be flat on my face.
I see that a lot, and it looks perilous to me, but for some dogs, it's the best way to get them a good, fast run. Is this a story you can share on the radio, Andy Mazur? Because Andy was just in the middle of a fascinating story to me, or maybe it's just between us fellers.
Well, I mean, people would like to know that you actually had a very big influence on my career, early in my career.
I was How's that?
An intern for you, and you also taught a class of mine of Bradley.
Oh, were you in my class?
Yeah.
So I was in WNBD in Peoria, which is still, if you're in Central Illinois, a great radio station to listen to. Hello to Greg and Dan and the gang. And I was working at WNBD.
Right.
You were my intern.
Yeah, and then I was also
a student
in your class because my parents were moving, and I went downstairs into the basement to clear out some of my stuff. And I opened up a folder, and it was the folder with your class in it. We were doing editing on reel-to-reel tapes. And all that kind of fun stuff, and learning about broadcasting.
Do you remember what grade you got for me, Andy?
It better have been an A. I'll go back and look.
I don't remember.
I don't know either.
I think I was regarded as kind of a tough teacher, only because I was so into it. I'm like, you know,
yeah.
It's not like I'm super smart, or which was trying to be tough, but I just thought, yeah, broadcasting, let's go.
Yeah. It was a fun class.
I remember the very first day that I taught, and I was a relatively young man down there in Peoria, Illinois, and I couldn't believe that I was getting to teach at Bradley University. But given my experience in the class, which was sort of like trends in broadcasting or something, it was appropriate for everybody. But the first day, I was under the impression that the classes were twice a week, 90 minutes, instead of three times a week, 50 minutes.
Right, yep.
So I'm going on in about 80 minutes, 85 minutes, and one of the kids raises their hand. They go, are you going to let us go? And I said, yeah, in about 5 minutes. And she goes, I thought this was an hour-long class. And everybody looked at me and nodded their head. Uh-huh. It's an hour-long class. Uh-huh. And the first session, we're like 25 minutes over. I said, why didn't you guys tell me? They go, well,
you're
the teacher. And we're new, and we didn't want to be the upstart kid that says, hey, let us out.
Yeah.
So I gave one of the students an eraser. I said, from now on, at 49 minutes and 30 seconds, so at the start of each class, I would hand them one of the erasers. And I would say, if I'm over the limit, hit me with the eraser. You have my permission to throw there. You do not deserve to be here any longer than you signed up for. And by God, they were good at it.
That's good.
I never went over again.
Broadcasting and marksmanship.
Andy, I'm very proud of you.
Yeah, thank you very
much. You're a good student.
Appreciate it.
You want to go to the doctor? Oh, my God, me neither. That's no fun, right? But it can be fun if you go to the Joint Relief Institute. The staff at the Joint Relief Institute, two locations in the Chicago area, is so warm and they are so friendly. Really, they know why you're coming in. You've got knee pain. You want it to go away. And what they're happy about is the pain relief you're going to get. Their fast, non-surgical, pain-free procedure isolates where your tissue has deteriorated, and then they put a joint lubricant into the exact spot. It's like putting a pillow in there to cushion your every step. Nice people greet you. It's a fast, pain-free procedure. And then you're walking and climbing and dancing and smiling. Your first visit to evaluate your knee is free. They've got two locations, Orland Park and Oak Brook. It's the same phone number for either location, 708-888-0000. Visit jointreliefinstitute.com or call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain. We were talking about your dogs and the love they have for you. Hey, King John, what channel was that Dog Tales on? I couldn't find it. What channel is it on in Indiana? It was Nova. It was the February 12th episode called Dog Tales, and I don't know what channel you get public TV on. In Chicago, obviously, it's Channel 11. And I hope that it's available to view online. John 847 says, my dog loves me. Here's a couple of other texts. Actually, dogs know if one leaves the pack, they never return. As you return home, they are overwhelmed. So that greeting that the astronaut gets, or that a soldier gets, that a college kid gets when they return, it's the dog going, wait, somebody's come back to the pack. That never happens. When we leave home, Brenda will look at Daisy for the afternoon and say, we're coming back. Because the dog doesn't know. You could be abandoning them for all they know, right? They hardly speak any English. So you say, we'll be back. Just be good. If we turn on WGN, let Daisy listen to the radio while we're gone.
I think the animal that people question a lot is cats, and how much affection they feel towards their owners.
Yeah.
I made an observation that was kind of interesting. So cats, I don't have a cat anymore. I used to, but he would know when I was down the hallway coming back. I could hear him meowing from
oh, really?
Down the hall. Yeah. And I cat sat for one of my friends in her apartment, and just to rebut your point of food being the motivator of their love, I had fed this cat, obviously, and played with the cat, gave it attention. But while I was there, the owner arrived home. She got back from her trip, and the cat left me, ran to the door, and just was excited to see her.
I'm happy to see that person.
Yeah.
And it's not like the cat didn't like you, but obviously right. This was the A in the... Mm-hmm. It's funny, too, how pets will sometimes make up their minds about some people they don't like. There are some people that a dog or cat, for whatever reason, has decided they don't have much affection for, even though they might have it for a lot of other people. We sometimes think that that dog knows something that we don't.
Yeah.
Watch the videos, John, of soldiers reunited with their dogs after being separated for a long time. It brings tears every time. This texter said, animals do not have human emotions. Tell that to the planet. John, if a dog is... What was that, Steve?
Well, I just don't see how you can attribute to say some things dogs learn and they can do and they can be trained, and yet they're surprised every time you come home because they think you're gone forever. That doesn't make sense to me.
I'm sorry, what doesn't make sense to you?
Well, we dogs learn a lot of things. They learn where their food is. They learn what time to go to the bowl. They bark. They have all these great learning capabilities. And yet you're saying that they think every time you leave that you're never coming back and that they're always surprised.
I wonder that. I mean, really, because for all they know, you are going on vacation for 2 weeks.
But if you come back every day at the same time.
Yeah.
My dog used to go to their food bowl every day at the same time.
Yeah. Our first wiener dog, Fred, who is, by the way, America's largest wiener dog, kind of knew when I was walking down the street, kind of to Elif's point, when I was coming down the street home to our house in LaGrange, he would get ready and go to the door, Brenda would tell us. But I don't know what your point is, Steve, because I think that it is true that an animal can't know. Maybe you are leaving.
Well, the point, I just was raising issue with the idea that every time you leave, dogs don't return to the pack, so they're shocked to see you come home.
Oh, I see.
And that doesn't follow with the fact that they learn so many other things.
Yeah. John, if a dog is walking down the street and sees a police dog, does it think it's a cop? We don't know everything that they are thinking. But that's the story from... Channel 11 the other night, that the dog really does have human affection for you. They did an MRI scan or a brain scan when the dog was getting food and it was happy, but when it associates something with its owner, then it really lights up more so than when it's just food for affection. It's kind of intrigued by what Steve Alexander was saying about how the coronavirus is affecting international trade. I have some news, notes, and numbers about that. We'll talk about more in the 11 o'clock hour, but producer Elif just shared with me a text she got from someone, and it is the Dean Kuntz book, The Eyes of Darkness. And on page, I'm just looking at the page here, is it two something? It talks about a virus. This is just a work of fiction, right? And let me see if I can blow it up. No, it's not cooperating here. Don't do that. Yeah, read the highlighted part that you have there, Olive.
It says they call the stuff Wuhan 400 because it was developed at their rDNA. It was around then that a Chinese scientist named Li Chen defected to the United States carrying a diskette record of China's most important and dangerous new biological weapon in a decade. They call this stuff Wuhan 400 because it was developed at their rDNA labs outside of the city of Wuhan, and it was the 400th viable strain of man-made microorganisms created at that research center. And then it goes on, Wuhan 400 is a perfect weapon.
Yeah.
It afflicts only human beings. No other living creature can carry it. And like syphilis, Wuhan 400 can't survive outside a living human body for longer than a minute. It's just kind of grave and creepy the way that this...
But this is a work of fiction. It's a thriller from 1981, Stephen Kuntz, The Eyes of Darkness. And it's about how the Chinese have made this Wuhan virus as a weapon. And that is the rumor that's going on out there. By the way, you're locked in here. That's the rumor going on out there, that this isn't just some random mutation of a virus that animals got, now human beings are getting, it's killing people and creating panic and worldwide stock problems, that this is an instrument of the Chinese and they're doing it on purpose, but now it's got outside their secret laboratory. And some members of the United States Senate are tweeting about this, saying, aha, we're on to something here.
And this is why it reminds me of Stranger Things on Netflix. Because there's a description, I don't know who wrote this, but it looks like an analysis of the book. And it says, author Dean Kutz tells of a Chinese military lab that creates a virus as part of its biological weapons program.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the premise for the book. And now we have this virus from, what do you know, the same place. But I'm going to chalk all of that up to coincidence and ask the Senate to just do things like, I don't know, balance the budget.
So to test out the virus, they're killing and sickening thousands of their own.
I think in the cotton conspiracy case, it's gotten outside the nearby laboratory, because there is a laboratory nearby.
It's like China syndrome.
It is a little bit like that. I was actually thinking about that. Andromeda Strain is another great sort of bio-thriller. But we digress. It's 10:10. Sam Panayanovich strolled into our studios. You know him as the sports expert who talks to me frequently about wagering in the world, but sports in general, too. Hi, Sam.
Happy Tuesday. It is Tuesday, right? Usually we talk on Friday or Saturday, so I'm a little...
Well, a lot of times Friday or Saturday or Monday, because we're going into or coming out of a big game, the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll talk in a Wednesday or Thursday in the near future when March Madness kicks off. But you sent me a text over last night that I just thought was, this is the world we live in. What are you talking about?
William Hill Sportsbook, at William Hill US, has released a prop for this baseball season.
What's a prop?
A prop is a propositional wager that you can make. It's not betting on a team or a total. It's a fun thing to bet on. Like we talked about the Gatorade prop. What color will the Gatorade be? And you said orange, and you got it right. How long will the national anthem be? They're fun bets, but they're bets. They're things you can wager on. You could bet on this legally at any William Hill book in the United States. The total times that the Astros will be hit by a pitch this season. And the number on that in 162 games is 83.5, which is essentially once every two games.
What's average?
John asked that yesterday. So the leaders last year in the clubhouse, the Mets were hit 95 times. The Reds were hit 89. The A's were hit 87. And the Chicago Cubs were hit 83. The average team was about 67-68.
How many of the 83 that the Cubs were hit were Rizzo? I'll bet...
A good
half
amount
of them. I'll bet half of them.
You know, I can look that up very quickly.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, the interesting part about this, the commissioner, who, by the way, has been blasted by some of baseball's best players, Mike Trout yesterday went off on the commissioner and how weak the punishments were, and the players did it, but the players aren't being punished. He's getting bashed by everybody, the commissioner. The commissioner came out and said, I need to protect my players. Player safety is very important. So if you throw at the Astros and make it obvious, you will face punishment, which is very interesting because they're not being punished for cheating in the World Series. It is what it is. 83.5, though, is the number. And I don't know where to even start with this. I have no idea.
Do you show where the Astros, how many times the Astros got hit last year? Because some players lean in, some players crowd the plate. Some players will take a curveball on the elbow to get to first base.
66 last year.
So a 25% increase we're expecting this year.
But if you're clearly headhunting, you will get a letter from the league.
That's actually a 30% increase.
Would you throw at an Astro player if you were a pitcher?
I don't understand the thing in baseball that allows that period, that whole you being our guy, we'll be your guy, or you hot dogged around the bases after a home run, so we're going to hit somebody coming up next. You're throwing a rock at somebody 100 miles an hour from 60 feet away. That's criminal to me. I don't understand that.
And the ball comes out of some players' arms like a bazooka, 99, 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So it's very tough. The ball can be a weapon. But let me tell you a funny story. My brother was playing in the White Sox organization. He was very good at St. Francis, all-time leader in wins and strikeouts in Joliet. And he ends up playing rookie ball in Great Falls, Montana, beautiful Great Falls, Montana, 2016. His first two starts didn't go that well. And I usually would try and call or text him before every start and say, hey, you got to establish the inside. After his first start, he gave up a lot of hits, gave up a home run, they lost. Text him before his second start and said, hey, first batter, chin music. Set the tone. Let him know you ain't messing around, right? Just throw one up near the ear hole, just to show him that you're in charge. I'm listening to the game, first pitch, ball one, he gets roughed up in that. So I call him before start number three. I say, hey, throw the first pitch at this guy's helmet. I'm listening to the radio broadcast at KGFX, whatever. First pitch, ooh, Panayotovich almost hit him right in the head. He goes 7 1/3, 5 hits, no earned runs. He made it known that, look, I'm going to establish the inside part of the play. Now, he didn't hit anybody, but it's that visual thing of, uh-oh, this guy's not afraid to go inside and paint the corner or go even closer.
Wasn't that a valuable asset for Kerry Wood?
Wood was not afraid to throw under your hands.
And Kerry was wild, and I don't know if we've all decided if his wildness was intentional or not, but sometimes you didn't know where the ball was going to go, and I always thought that kept guys honest.
That game, he struck out 20. I remember watching the Cubs put up a documentary a couple years ago. He struck out 20 Houston Astros players, and I think it was 98, and he said he had one of the worst warm-ups ever.
Yeah,
he didn't know where it was going. But then when he got on the mound, he was throwing that curveball. It looked like a friggin' frisbee.
Yeah.
It started on the inside corner, and then it landed low and away in the dirt. Yeah. And the fastball was rising and tailing. And when he was, and he's 19, 20 years old at that point.
That curveball was what ended. It took some of the life out of his career, right?
He threw a lot of innings.
In high school, didn't he pitch both ends of a doubleheader in the state high school tournament? And I think the Cubs already had drafted him or had their eye on him. They knew they were going to take him. This is the version of the story that's in my head. I'm not sure if any of this is true. But he threw about 200 pitches, which was great for the high school team, but really it just that's bad management by the coach at that high school program. If I was whoever was in charge of Kerry Wood's career for the Cubs, I would have rushed the field when he came out for the second game. No! This is our million-dollar arm.
Him and Mark Pryor.
Do you remember where you were? Do you remember where you were when Kerry pitched that?
Absolutely.
We pulled over in the parking lot of the Jewel in Western Springs to finish the game. How about you, Steve?
Well, I was watching. I was working here at the Tribune Tower, and then I went across to my health club at Lakeshore, which is gone, I think, on Wabash, and watching it on the screens there.
That had to be a 120 first pitch, right?
Yeah.
So I was probably, I had probably just gotten home from school when he struck out 20.
Yeah.
It was a gloomy, dark day.
Yeah. We were listening to the radio, and we just, you know, it's like, oh, this kid's pitching good, but it kept getting so much better that you thought, we have to, I didn't even want to drive. And pulled over.
If you let Bob Sirac get close to a microphone, he'll claim he called it.
He ran in here. He actually ran in here.
Funny story that morning. We were doing Fox Thing in the morning, Marianne and I, and it was a very gray day, drizzly, kind of cool, and I wanted to go to the game. I felt something special was going to happen. I just had a feeling about Kerry Wood, so I mentioned it on TV. I couldn't get anybody to go to the game with me. I invited everybody, and couldn't get anybody to go. So I just went by myself and got a good seat. And about the fifth or sixth inning, I leaned over to the woman next to me who was keeping score, and I said, how many strikeouts does he have? And that's when he started to realize something was going to happen. So Wood finishes up 20 strikeouts, and then I get in my car, and on the way home, I'm hearing people call up Steve Dahl and tell him, hey, did you hear about Surratt this morning on TV, what he said? And they were talking about the Wood game. But it was a game that I think now 100 million people claim they were there.
I was just going to say, what was the
attendance there? It was very low.
I'm looking up the attendance.
It was early in the season. It was
May 6, 1998. Yeah. 120 first pitch. The attendance was 15,758.
I was the 58th, yeah.
That's funny because people knew Kerry Wood was going to be an interesting player. Like the walk-up for Michael Kopech was probably 15,000 or 10. I'll bet it was 10,000.
It rained that day, too, I believe. I believe it started raining
yeah,
after the first
inning.
The
point is, the yeah. Sox drew, I don't know what the number was for Kopech's game, but it was 20,000 plus, which was a good number for them. You'd think the Cubs for Kerry Wood would get that.
I'm looking at this box score, too. No, it's interesting. So he only had 15 after 7. So he comes out in the 8th inning, strikeout, strikeout, strikeout. And then in the 9th, strikeout, 19. Ground out, and then he struck out Derek Bell to end the game. So he was getting stronger as the game kept going.
It should have been a no-hitter, really, because that one play,
I was wondering about
the one hit was a scratch infield hit, wasn't it, as I recall? And, you know, it's funny. I think it's MLB Network. They replay that game occasionally, and I see myself behind home plate.
Oh, do you really? Really?
Yeah. So I have proof, okay?
And you weren't texting at the time, which is
no,
nice.
I was paying attention.
Because we couldn't text back then, I don't think, anyway. We sure weren't so married to our phones. It's a good thing they didn't take him out for pitch count reasons either, right?
138 pitches that game.
Nice. Nice. Okay, so back to the Astros. That's fun, Bob. One of the 15 million people that were at that game that day.
122 pitches. Still a lot.
I don't even believe Surratt's story. Surratt was home in bed.
Check the videotape.
I love how Bob does not need to explain anything to us. He's like, I was there. I was there. You could see me.
Yeah, you've got proof. So, the Astros.
83.5 times that their batters will be hit by a pitch this year. I would think it would probably go under. I think that number's a little high.
The teams are all in Florida now, getting ready for the season. They're getting ready for the preseason games. Come on, Sam.
You know the Cubs and Sox both train in Arizona, right? Did you not know that for real?
I knew that.
I don't think you did.
You were all over me on the phone last night going, John, pretty sure I knew the Cubs and Sox were in Arizona.
Sometimes I don't know if you're playing dumb.
I don't either.
I have no idea.
Thing about
like,
me.
When you asked me if Robbie Gould was really kicking for the Niners, I didn't know if you were serious or not. When you asked when the Super Bowl was, I didn't know if you were for real or not. I never really know, and that's what makes it fun.
So both teams are reported, and they're getting ready now.
I was watching. You know how excited I am for the White Sox season. I was watching B-roll yesterday of Eloy Jimenez, and I'm like, whoa, he looks big. And they're showing footage of them hitting in a cage. But you still get excited.
Just watching their stroke, and they weren't over-swinging. They were just, it was fun to watch that. Give me a couple of takeaways since we're on the White Sox, and then give me a couple of takeaways for the Cubs.
I think it's very important what the White Sox have done in their offseason, because remember, the Cubs, before things turned, were bad and then had to draft a lot of young players, right? They had to draft, you know, the Chris Bryants and the Kyle Schwarbers and the Albert Almoras, and then they had to make savvy trades when they flipped, I believe it was Steve Clevenger and Scott Feldman for Jake Arrieta. Right, in 2013, you make savvy trades. And then when you know that your young players are ready, you have to supplement them with veterans. And in 2015, the Cubs brought in Dexter Fowler, John Lester, David Ross, and Miguel Montero. The following year, they bring in Jason Hayward and Ben Zobrist. Now, those are names,
wow.
But the context is there was a flurry of veterans that knew how to win and knew how to set the tone in the locker room to merge with your younger players. That's 2015. 2016, they win in October, actually November 2016. The Sox are doing the same thing. And that's the takeaway. They've brought in a slew of vets.
Give me the names.
Well, Dallas Keuchel, Edwin Encarnacion.
Encarnacion's had 30 home runs for the last seven seasons.
He's a monster. Yasmani Grandal, the catcher, arguably one of the best defensive catchers in the game.
Here's what worries me about Encarnacion, that this will be the year that they go, yeah, and now he hit 14.
Here's the issue with Encarnacion. If it's 26 degrees for the whole month of April, he's not going to hit a lot of home runs. There have been a lot of players that have come into the Southside and had rough April and Mays because it's just too cold to tee up a baseball.
How important is it to, for Anderson to have the kind of season he had last year?
It's going to be tough to hit that well again average-wise. I mean, he hit almost 335, and he had what they call baseball luck. He had a very high average on balls in play, so there should be some regression there. But Anderson, it's just the personality and the aggressiveness. And he's not, he even said, I don't walk, because that's the knock. Well, he doesn't walk enough. He's a free-swinging spirit. And if he sees a fastball over the middle on the first pitch, he's going to hack at it. And that's just the way he plays. You never want your players to change the way they play. And I think the Cubs did that, even though Theo and Judd will never admit this. Remember how good Starlin Castro was when he came up? He had like 200 hits a couple times. He was a first ball, fastball hitting player. And they were like, you need to see more pitches. And that sort of threw him off. And then they traded him. He wasn't on the World Series team, but they sort of messed with Starlin Castro. Don't mess with your young players.
But Castro swung at a lot of bad pitches.
He was an all-star.
He swung at pitches that were feet off the plate, where, you know, he just made up his mind, I'm swinging, which I understand why players do that sometimes, but I mean, nobody was more frustrating at the plate than Starlin Castro.
He was an all-star.
He took swings at the ground balls that went by him when he wasn't set.
he was an all-star.
I love that story.
He was an all-star at 21, 22, and 24.
He would sometimes not be in a fielding position when the ball left the pitcher's hand. And in one play, he actually had his back to home plate. He was looking into the outfield when the pitcher threw the ball. A grounder to him would have hit him in the butt.
I'm not saying they shouldn't have traded him. I'm not saying that he was the greatest player in the world. I'm just saying they messed with his psyche because the Cubs' philosophy was we need to see more pitches.
Okay, so White Sox are doing what the Cubs did in 13, 14, and 15, building themselves a team that was ready in 16. And maybe it's too soon to count our chickens, but that's the position that they're in.
It's a window that is wide open, and it should not be predicated on what they do this year. It should be what they do the next 3, 4, 5 years.
I got 2 minutes to ask you about the Cubs, okay. But before you do, tell me the three players you're most excited to watch on the White Sox.
Eloy Jimenez, who I said looks like a monster. I'm excited for him. I'm excited to see what Lucas Giolito does. He was an all-star last season. I believe he's their ace. Excited for that. And then this young stud from Cuba, Luis Robert, who's built like a Mack truck. He's going to play center field. And he's the prize possession. He's one of the biggest signings they ever had. And that's going to be a player to watch. He's very young. He's never seen a major league pitch before. But I would say Eloy, Giolito, and Luis Robert.
Sure anxious to see Kopech and Cease and see if they can live to their potential, too. Okay, give me Cubs players.
David Ross, well, not a Cub player, now a manager. David Ross has said that he will not tinker with the lineup. So some of you Cub fans that hated Joe Maddon playing, what would he play, like that game where you put all the coins in and shake it up and just pull it out. Like that was the line. I don't even know what they call that game. But there will be a stable lineup where guys can get comfortable, and they will go back to having batting practice before games, and they will get more into the routine of preparing to play baseball. These are all things that David Ross said yesterday, because I believe some players were saying that they got a little lazy.
Even the players knew it. And when it works, that's a good thing. But if it's not working, maybe that's something to change, the culture.
I'm excited to see what Anthony Rizzo does. You and I have talked about his emotions recently and how he wants to be here long term, and they won't do it.
You're talking about Rizzo or Bryant?
Rizzo, I'm talking about.
But Bryant, too.
Well, and that's a decision they have to make, because it doesn't sound like Tom Ricketts is going to help spend for both Baez and Bryant. It doesn't sound that way.
Isn't it? So I go back a long time to Marquette when Hank Raymond succeeded Al McGuire, right? And then the guy who succeeded Hank Raymond was Rick Majerus. And Rick Majerus did not succeed at Marquette because he was the assistant coach under Raymond and he was the player's buddy. And when it came time to be the heavy, he couldn't do it. Rick Majerus went on to be a great college basketball coach, but not at the institution where he fostered these kids. I just wonder if there's going to be some of that with David Ross.
It's a very fair point. It's an interesting conversation. I mean, you know, he was drinking buddies with a lot of these guys, Steve, and now he's got to be, you know, the dictator. And maybe dictator, you don't like that word, but you have to be in control of that locker room, and you can't let any BS fly. And now you have to hold players accountable when you were out ripping shots of tequila with them 3 years ago.
15 seconds left. Give me the three players you're most interested in watching play for the Cubs this year.
Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, and I want to see if Albert Almora can make that leap in center field and be an everyday player.
Nice to talk to you, Sam. Thanks
you too,
for coming
man.
In. Sam Panionovich. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. It's 10:33. This is WGN Radio. I wasn't paying that much attention to the All-Star Game. I knew it was in Chicago. My only brilliant thing to say about it was I didn't think it was going to be getting as much attention as the All-Star Game in Chicago should. I thought the sort of visibility was low, given what a big deal that was. But then, lo and behold, it turned out to be a really good game. People liked the different scoring they had, where they counted quarters, not just total points. And then, to make it a sort of storybook ending, the winning shot, a free throw, is made by a guy from Chicago. And then a bunch of kids rush down onto the floor wearing Team LeBron t-shirts. And this is the part of the story that I really didn't know that much about. But because LeBron's team wins, his charity of choice is Chicago-based, and $400,000 goes to this children's program in Chicago for arts in the schools. What a good idea, and what a fat check that is. Jeff Beckham Jr. is on the phone line to tell us a little bit more about that. He serves as the Vice President of Partnerships at Chicago Scholars. Jeff, you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
First, tell me a little bit about Chicago Scholars. What is that?
So Chicago Scholars is a college access career and leadership development nonprofit. We help kids from Chicago, from CPS schools, get to college, through college, and into their jobs.
And so it's CPS-wide, is that right?
Yeah, we work with kids from every school. So scholars apply, young people apply at the end of their junior year in high school to be part of Chicago Scholars. And then through that whole senior year, we provide them with college counseling, with mentoring, with leadership development, and opportunities to understand what it means to be in college, but understand who they are as young superpowers, superheroes, is what we tell them. And to date, Chicago Scholars has worked with more than 3,500 young people in Chicago. And we're actually working towards selecting our next class of 700 high schoolers who will take part in the program next year.
Is it arts-centric, or is it across all the curricula?
So it's not arts. It's actually college access. We work in all the curricula. So we help kids who want to go into STEM, who want to become our future doctors and lawyers, who are writers, authors, business people. I mean, we have kids in every discipline.
I see. So maybe my mistake was one of the kids quoted in the paper was a student at the Chicago High School for the Arts, but
yeah,
he could have been a STEM student or something else as well.
Yeah, Luis is interested in going into graphic design and wants to be an author as well. He's a phenomenal kid who actually wrote a letter to Boston Celtic Jason Tatum where he shared that, you know, because of this, he felt seen and heard as a young leader and is actually going to include Jason in his children's book that he's starting next year.
Is it income driven or is it just grades driven? How do kids get into the program?
Yeah, good question. All of the kids that we work with are either first-generation college going or they're from a low-income family. And so, you know, these kids are kids who will be the first in their families to go into a four-year university and more than likely the first in their family to work in some of the same corporations that we're partnering with to get them jobs. And so they're really those two criteria. They also have to have demonstrated leadership, meaning that they are leaders in their school. They might be on the debate team, play sports, or academically ambitious students who are also leaders in their community. And when they apply, we find out all this information about them. We have a robust application process where over 1,500 students will apply. We'll interview 1,000 next month, and then we'll select 700 in June who will take part in this program over the course of the next 7 years.
Over the course of the next 7 years. So you follow them through their college career then?
Yeah, we stay with them through their college career, and we even work with them as young alumni who are now in the workforce. We do financial literacy workshops. We help them with resume informational interviews. We connect them with the companies that we have relationships with. So it's a really robust program with the idea, and we recognize that, you know, college isn't enough anymore. You have to have the right network and the right people around you, and you have to have the right skills to really be successful. And so we're helping build these young leaders who will come back to Chicago and hopefully be my boss one day. That's the goal, and sit at different tables to create opportunities for other young people just like them.
When these kids are in high school, do the Chicago Scholars stay in their high schools, or do they then migrate to one central school?
So when they're in high school, they go, they're at each of their high schools, but yeah, they come to our office each month for a workshop where that mentor, the mentor team and the counselors work with them on all like the kind of initial college access skills. And then once they're in school and they get into their accepted colleges, we work with them again and enhance their leadership by doing different workshops around communication and team building, collaboration. We teach them the hard skills like Excel and Microsoft Word so that they're ready and prepared and capable in whatever they choose to do. We don't coach them to one individual career path. We help them find where they're going in their course of their journey. I always tell, you know, friends that this is kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure book for career and leadership development.
Jeffrey Beckham Jr. is the Vice President of Partnerships at Chicago Scholars. Find out more at chicagoscholars.org. Their organization got $400,000. Am I reading that correctly from the NBA All-Star Game?
Yes, sir. Team LeBron, NBA Cares, and the NBA provided $400,000 for us in that big win on Sunday.
What if you guys were on the losing team? Would you have still gotten money?
Yes, so they guarantee that the losing team would get at least $100,000. And so, you know, for us, that's a huge amount of money that helps us tremendously. It will impact our scholars greatly. And, you know, we are friendly with After School Matters, who is the other team on the other side. Individually, interestingly enough, in Chicago, a lot of our Chicago scholars take part and After School Matters programs, and a lot of After School Matters students are Chicago scholars. And so we see it as a big win for the city.
Still, that free throw is a $300,000 free throw for you then, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you saw our faces when he missed the first one, I mean, you could hear a pin drop in the room, and you know, when he hit the second one, our scholars were celebrating, and the NBA did a wonderful job. They had streamers falling from the sky, and we had, you know, big Team LeBron signs, and Russell Westbrook was standing there at the baseline, ushering the scholars to rush the court. So it changed the dynamic of the game, but made it feel like it, almost of sorts, like you were watching a Final Four basketball game, a national championship. That's what it felt like.
You know, Jeffrey, it's easy for people like me and you or anybody to be pretty cynical about professional sports these days. And without even going down that road, let's just take this at what it is. This was smart. It was well done. Its heart and its head are in the right place. I'm just so happy for you guys. But I still have more questions about your program per se. Do the kids that qualify, and they're going to get this mentorship for the next 7 years, do you help them financially get into the colleges that they may be eligible for?
That's a good question. In a way, we do. What we have done is partnered. We work with University of Chicago. We use their fit and match algorithm, which helps us understand what's the right school and matrix and mix for kids, right? So it takes into account their major, their interests, but also their financial situations to look at what school would provide them the most financial aid.
Yeah.
But we also have some platinum partner schools who actually backfill any unmet merit need for our kids. So we do have a set of schools that will, you know, fill that gap for kids who need extra help to get to school.
What's your story? Are you a product of CPS? Where'd you come from?
So I'm not a product of CPS, but I am from Chicago. I'm from the Auburn Gresham community. I grew up here. Both my parents are Lynn Bloom alum and diehard Chicago fans, and just have always been interestingly connected to the community. I'm a Bronzeville resident now. I work and live in the neighborhood, and I've always worked as a mentor through programs and organizations. For coming to Chicago Scholars, I worked in the technology sector.
You know, the space in the room right now is very sacred.
Pardon me, keep going.
See, seeing the gap in the amount of black and brown people in tech inspired me to come work with the kids that I could get to at the earliest levels to help them get into those fields and sectors. And so, you know, when the opportunity came to come work at Chicago Scholars and help with the partnership work, to partner with companies and organizations who recognize the talent and the power of young talent, it was something that I leapt at the opportunity to do. And I'm really just grateful to be here. If you could imagine, I didn't plan to have the opportunity to work with the scholars in the NBA in this way, but it's a dream come true for me as well.
Yeah. I've heard, and maybe you can comment on this, I need to take a quick commercial break, but one of the, I think, challenges for families who don't have a history of academic success is that even if the kid is demonstrating the potential, and you say, why aren't the parents more involved? It's because the parents had bad experiences. They're intimidated. They didn't like school, and they literally have no reference point on how to succeed or how to even enjoy it. And I'm wondering if you can just talk about that hurdle for some of these kids, too. Hooray for them, huh? $400,000. We'll finish this conversation in a minute. After the NBA All-Star Game, that one-point win, a free throw cinches it, and Team LeBron wins. The charity of his choice gets $400,000, and it's the one that Jeffrey Beckham Jr. is in charge of, or at least the corporate partnerships, Chicago Scholars. We were just making the point you were, Jeffrey, about these families and where they come from, and I wondered if it's a special challenge if those families don't have a history of academic success. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, the research shows that, you know, families that come from low-income communities in the lowest quartile have a lot of trouble in graduating from Chicago, from college. And in Chicago, only about 19% of CPS students who aspire for a bachelor's degree are projected to get one in 6 years. At Chicago Scholars, 83% of our kids graduate within 6 years. And so, when you look at the supports and the programming that we're providing, it does overcome a lot of those hurdles. And John, you made a really great point. And if you think about it, if you're the first in your family to go to college, to walk on a campus, to do the FAFSA, to find friends, to know how to talk to professors, all of those things are huge challenges for young people. And then those same young people graduate, they fight through, and they have to figure those same things out in companies. How do you network at the corporate reception? How do you ask your boss for more work? How do you navigate some of the same systems and processes and challenges? And so, you know, that is what we do. We, you know, provide supports and people and a curriculum to help young people make it through kind of those two critical transition points in their life.
I'll let you go, Jeffrey, but is there one big thing you're all going to spend the money on? I mean, it, I presume, is literally a deposit to your accounts of $400,000. Where's that money going to go?
Yeah, you know, we've grown as an organization in the last few years, and so the fund's going to help us build out even more career and leadership development programming to enhance all of what we do for our scholars so that our kids are not only graduated from college, but they're getting those key internships. They're developing those soft skills. They're attending more workshops and conferences across the country, and they're growing their network so that when they graduate, they're ready to step up as leaders in their careers and communities. You know, we know our scholars have the talent to become Chicago's next generation of leaders, and we're happy that the NBA and LeBron James recognize that these young people do too as well. Chicago has a lot of talent. Our young people have a lot of talent, and our kids deserve the opportunity to show and shine, and we're just grateful that we've been able to see that this past weekend, and we hope it continues with the city in partnership moving forward.
I see you're a DePaul grad?
Yes, and Mizzou. Mizzou undergrad, DePaul grad.
Okay. I'm going to be at the game tomorrow night, and I'm worried about our chances against Villanova, just in case you're wondering what I'm thinking about that game.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. But, you know, I have faith that our team was doing really well, and I hope to see them in the tournament can pull it through. And I love Charlie Moore. So.
Yeah, Charlie, he needs to slow down sometimes.
But, he does.
He can really surprise you, too. It was a fun first half of the season, a frustrating Big East turn now, but I'll wish him luck, and congratulations to you and everybody over there, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much, John. We really appreciate this opportunity to talk about our program. And you know, if you're out there and you want to be a mentor for our program, please go to our website. We're still taking student applications, so if you know a high school junior, have them apply, please.
And that website is?
ChicagoScholars.org.
All right, Jeffrey, let's visit again.
Thank you, sir.
There he goes. It's 10:49. This is WGN. I've been looking at the numbers on the coronavirus. Have you? 73,000 infected now, 1,873 killed. And on that Diamond Princess cruise ship, 544. The number of people who have come down with the illness. I think they're starting to think twice about, is it a good idea to get people off the ship or a good idea to take people, keep people on the ship? I'm voting for take them off the ship. Steve Alexander was reporting earlier on the business side about the economic impact of this thing.
Yes, I was.
You're still looking at those numbers, huh?
Yeah, global. You know, this is a global deal, John, and you can't. It's hard to think of an industry that is not impacted by this in some way.
I'm trying to think of another instance where, you know, when Ebola happened or when SARS happened or
SARS,
something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was there this sort of economic impact? And I just don't recall that.
Yeah, there was with SARS, and I don't have a comparison right off the bat, but it did impact all sorts of, you know, manufacturing and other business activity.
Yeah.
After the outbreak of SARS, and that was early 2000s, I guess. And, you know, obviously all of that came back. In this case, we're still on the front end of this, and it's still spreading. Countries around China are beginning to feel the impact. South Korea, Japan, they're very concerned. The French, let's see, where is it? The French health minister is warning a credible risk of a coronavirus pandemic, which is basically a worldwide epidemic. So, you know, we're still seeing how this is going to shake out.
I saw this on CNN today. Wuhan hospital director has died.
Right.
Li Zhiming, head of the Wuchang Hospital in Wuhan. So the guy in charge of the hospital in Wuhan has died from coronavirus. He died this morning. Mm-hmm. The first hospital head to die of the virus. The U.S. has evacuated more than 300 Americans from that ship, 14 of whom tested positive for the virus. Actually, 544 people have come down with the illness. Wow.
Yeah, and to give you an example on the business side of it, Apple, of course, is the most famous company that has been impacted by it. It said its factories in China are shut down. iPhone sales to China, which is a huge market for Apple, are expected to be lower because people can't go out to shop. The stores are shut down, and people, you know, they're not allowed to go out anyway. But some of the other companies you might not expect would be impacted by this. Haagen-Dazs has had to close about half of its stores in China because of the coronavirus. Holiday Inn, which has hotels all over the world, is seeing its revenue fall in China because of the closures because of this.
So, Steve, when you're talking about it being a global crisis, you're talking about it because global companies have so much business in China.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not that they're feeling it in Belgium.
Right, which is an interesting point. I mean, it's a global crisis, not because Belgians are coming down with the disease, but simply a Belgian company does business in China, and it
yes.
hurts that business.
Right.
Yeah. It does. If nothing else, it speaks to how much economic might China has, right? I think you kind of lose that. Every day you go to the store, you buy something, you don't even think about it. If China gets sick, the whole world suffers.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? China suffers, gets a cold, and the whole world sneezes? Or there's a saying like that.
It's nothing like that, actually, but yeah.
There's a saying that involves sneezing.
O'Hare Airport, I think.
I believe there's a saying that involves sneezing. Ella, find all sayings about sneezing. Get them back to me in a minute. Carrie Mansicola sobbed after learning that she and hundreds of other Americans evacuated would face 14 additional days of quarantine in the U.S. They had already been quarantined on the cruise ship since February 4th. She said, "This is a month of my life I don't get back being quarantined and re-quarantined."
Here's another impact, and this is impacting U.S. automakers, and that's the Beijing Auto Show, which is the largest auto show in the world, has been postponed indefinitely. It was supposed to be held in late April. So and that's important to car makers because China, again, is just a huge market.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've feel like whatever the grave inconvenience it is, you appreciate the efforts to which these countries and companies are going, or maybe you're completely frustrated and angry because this shows how we aren't prepared for something like this. I'm impressed, though, with that hospital in Nebraska, which, you know, they're sending people to and has the hazmat suits and the protocols. I mean, in some ways, this is very impressive, and in other ways, it looks like a cluster, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Carl Goldman, 66, and his wife, Jerry Cerati Goldman, were aboard the Diamond Princess, were under quarantine at the Omaha facility. I am being tended to by two nurses in full hazmat suits, and the doctor who visited me wears a hazmat suit. My wife and I are in separate wings of this facility. We talked to each other via FaceTime. He tested positive for the virus. His wife has tested negative, and they'll spend a full month in quarantine just to make sure they don't give it to somebody else in the States. Most of the people infected are still in China. 73,000 with 1,800 killed now, and 544 on that Diamond Princess cruise ship, which Dan Ponce's mother-in-law is famously on now, have come down with that illness. The Ponce's, though, we heard this morning from Dan, are not showing any signs of the illness. So hopefully that'll stay that way.
In comparison, I was just reading the SARS numbers. SARS ended up killing fewer than 800 people, infecting about 8,000. So far more people, it sounds like, are being impacted.
How about that?
Infected by this, but not being killed by it.
Our Steve Alexander with the business and some of that. Thank you, Steve. 1108, this is WGN Radio. John Williams here. Phone number's 312-981-7200 to join us along the way. 312-981-7200. I just wanted to take a minute to tell you a story about a colleague of ours here at the radio station, Ernie Skatten. Ernie has a young family, and his wife had a massive stroke last month. I bumped into Ernie in production the other day because, well, he has spent most of his waking hours at his wife's bedside in the hospital. He is trying to get some work done here as well. So he and I were chatting in the studio, and we were just kind of catching up. His family should be worried about college choices right now and softball practices and the White Sox. Ernie loves his kids. His daughter's a good softball player. He loves his baseball team. He loves his family. And if you bump into Ernie, you will hear about all of those in 30 seconds. They should be worried about what's for dinner. But now they're working on things like his wife's speech and cognition and movement and trying to decipher what she understands and what she wants and needs. And will she be able to attend their daughter's graduation, which is a goal that Ernie has set for them? Justine is 49 years old. She's got everything in front of her. And they've got four kids, twin boys, Rakim and Hakim, daughters Kayla. And Kaya is the one that wants to go to one of the black southern colleges. And Ernie was talking to me the other day about what those options are. And I believe Kaya's point was, well, maybe I shouldn't go away to school. And he says, no, this is your life and it's your future and you need to do what's best for you. Your mom wants you to do what's best for you. I want you to do what's best for you. But this is the kind of life that Ernie is living on a daily basis right now. So he's at the 7-Eleven the other day. And he watches a harried clerk work two registers at the same time. One over here and then he goes over, brings up somebody over there, back and forth. A customer felt that someone else got waited on before him when he should have been waited on first. And even after the clerk finally got to this other unhappy customer, the customer stands around and now he's yelling at the clerk that he wasn't waited on in time. He didn't get his turn first. So he's giving him grief instead of leaving the store. He's already made his purchase. And Ernie had had enough. He told me, I said, literally, he said, bro, this isn't that serious. It just isn't. You've been crying about it longer than it took for him to serve you. Just relax. This is not that serious. And then the guy mumbles something to Ernie. And Ernie said he didn't have the nicest look about him. And the guy finally walks out. He said, as tired as I was, I just couldn't put up with it. So the guy leaves. And a lady behind Ernie commends him and says, it's good that you stepped up for the clerk in that situation. And then Ernie said, well, my wife just had a stroke. And I know a little bit right now about pressure. And I know a little bit. He didn't go on at great length. I wasn't there, but this is Ernie's version of it, and I believe it. But he just said, you know, so I know a little bit about what matters right now. And stuff like that doesn't matter. And I said, Ernie, that's a great perspective for those of us that are frustrated with all of the little things in our lives, and we're ready to blow up and you are dealing with that stuff on a daily basis, missing your turn at the store is not a big deal. So Ernie's Mr. Positive, right, Steve?
Oh, my God. They've been waiting for you to just the grace and the joy. I mean, there's almost joy in the way he's handling this. It's just so inspiring. I mean, it's just moving.
Steve, that's what I told him. I said, Ernie, you're making us feel better about it instead of the other way around. And now you tell me this story about how we should all just have a little bit better perspective. And it wasn't Ernie's point to. It just came up in conversation, and he told it. And I said, Ernie, stop. You just did me another favor again with the crisis your family is going through. I mean, I'm upset about the cost of the Cubs on my cable, you know, or I'm upset about something the president said, or I'm upset about something. Dang, I got nothing to be upset about, Ernie. So wish the Scattons the best. And know that with somebody like Ernie and the family, that they will get as much positive juju as possible.
This is be happy. We got people like Ernie in the world. My God,
that's the truth.
And he's being proactive about it too.
What do you mean by that, Mary?
About the care. You know, he's kind of working a step ahead. Of everything to make sure his wife is comfortable, and that's so cool. I don't know how he's doing it.
Well, his daughter literally, because he was talking to me some time ago about how excited they were about the daughter's choices and is she making the right choice for college, the kind of conversation we all have. And then this happens. And so now it's, can the mother attend the high school graduation? Can she be there when her daughter walks across the threshold? And Ernie's like, that's going to happen. I just told her, you're going to be there. You know, that's it, which is so very Ernie again of him. But the takeaway for me after just us visiting in his studio was, you know, I got no reason to hold my hat and mope around in this world because there's just too much good in my life and I'm not having to deal with that.
Now, let's tell Ernie he has to be here every day just to make us feel better about ourselves.
It's the least he could do.
And he will.
Yeah. He will.
The problem is you got to listen to a story about the White Sox first because Ernie is, he has his enthusiasms and you cannot escape them. So our best to all of them. And thank you, Ernie. Thank you, Ernie, for being that kind of person. Our best to your family. It's 11:14. I mean, literally, you know why the next thing on my list of things I wanted to talk about was the guy that was punching the lady's seat on the airplane. This is exactly what I'm talking about. We all need to get a grip. She shouldn't have put her seat all the way back, and he should not have punched the seat. But let's just all get a little perspective here, right? On Facebook at WGNradio.com, that's our webpage. On my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John. The question I asked was, what is the one sentence of wisdom? Like, what's the unassailable truth that the viral video of the guy punching the woman's seat in front of him when she leaned back. What is the wisdom that we've taken away from this? And I got a list, let me tell you. Now, maybe this is your chance to call in, too. 312-981-7200. I'll go first. The airlines were wrong. The airlines made this problem, and it's their bad to fix. Hey, Jeff, you're on WGN Radio. What did you want to say? You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, good morning. You know, here's my comment about the flying. I fly a lot and fly a lot internationally. You know, the problem is that the woman could have handled that better, perhaps. But you know what? You pay for that seat. You absolutely have the right to put it back. And I'll go a step further and say, if in fact that was a man, he never would have done that.
Say that again.
If it would have been a man in the seat in front of that gentleman who was punching the seat, he never would have punched the seat.
Because why?
Because of gender. There was absolutely no way he would have done it.
Because he's afraid the guy's going to sock him in the nose, or just because it's...
Because he's afraid he's going to have a real conflict. I don't think he was really expecting a conflict from the woman.
Do you agree with me that this is a situation the airlines have created by cramming too many people in with too few options?
Oh, 110%. I can go further than that. I pay for upgrades on seats, and that's turned into where I don't even get what I used to get in a normal economy seat 10 years ago.
I don't agree with you guys. I think it's the equivalent of throwing your food just because you don't like the airline food. I mean, it's not the airline's fault that you behave terribly like that.
No, but it's the airline's. But here's the way I get that, Steve. And here's my attitude about that. The airline knows there's food throwers. The airline knows that people this is such a point of contention, and they don't do anything about it. They just look away like, well, it's not our problem. You built the airplanes. These are your planes. You're putting all of us in there, and you know some people are jerks. So what, are you going to divorce yourself of this?
It's not even that they built the planes. The fact of the matter is they have reduced the amount of inches these seats can recline. I just flew an international flight back in a 57 3 days ago, and, you know, there's no longer, even in business class where I was at, there's no longer the footrest that comes up.
Boy, don't you hate that. What did that ticket cost you, too?
We won't talk about that.
I appreciate your phone call. It's a good point. Thanks for joining us. And Steve, you're 6'6" tall. You more than anybody should appreciate the fact that the airlines have created an untenable situation for you.
There are times when people in front of me recline for no good reason and, you know, are not sleeping or whatever. But it would never, ever excuse me punching the seat for repeated times the way he did.
I love that phrase, recline for no good reason, as though they have to justify finding a comfortable position for themselves. But you can't. But that's the deal, right? You can't do both. I can't be comfortable without making you uncomfortable. And that's the environment the airlines have created. Think about that. I mean, the lady going back is well within her right, but in exercising her right, you know she's making the guy behind her miserable. That's the world.
But they've also created, you're right, it's not comfortable to fly a lot of times. Trust me, with my business, it's the biggest hassle I have are people who want specific seats. But it's also very affordable to fly these days, and that's one of the reasons why. I'm going to hop on a plane Thursday, go and see my daughter for 3 days.
Right.
You know? And if there were fewer, more spacious planes flying, they'd be a lot more expensive.
You make it sound as though I can't have my cake and eat it.
Well, I'll be cramming everything into my carry-on bag so I don't pay them $50. You know, we now have a deal with one airline, I won't name them, but we assign for the group seats. And if they want to choose their own seat, they have to call the airline and pay them another extra $30.
Steve Bertrand, Travel, obviously. This is the place you're coming from on this. It's not for the radio station's news, but you actually run a travel business. You fly and send people internationally all the time.
Right.
And it just seems to me like the airlines, I don't know where their profit centers are, but if they lost some space on the floor with the seats, I'd rather them make it up somewhere else. Charge more for those little gin bottles that I buy, or do something. But put it this way, short of that, they are creating the environment that is going to take hundreds of thousands of people, and problems are going to happen.
Well, I'm 6'4", 6'5", and I fly overseas, and I often fly in a window seat next to Sharon, so she's smaller, and it's just 6 hours, or it's just 7 hours. And I understand people are paying good money and they want to be comfortable, but sometimes we get so consumed by it that it ends up ruining our trip.
Listen to this. I think this is the solution. Kathy's online too. Kathy, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, what do you say?
So here's my solution. Just don't have the seats recline. Problem solved.
There's a gadget you can buy that you put on the seat in front of you that actually keeps it from reclining, which strikes me as being like completely illegal, but you can actually do that. Punching the seat for 4 hours is probably not the best solution.
So if those seats don't recline, no one has a problem.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. That's why I'm with you completely. By the way, so that woman, whose name interestingly is Wendy Williams, was on, she did an interview with TMZ. And some of the questions that you might have about that scenario were answered by that interview. Here's 60 seconds of it.
How hard was he hitting the back of your seat?
Hard. Like, I flew forward several times, and then I just kind of leaned forward because I knew it was coming.
It happened on a flight from New Orleans to Charlotte when Wendy Williams reclined her seat shortly after takeoff. How did this start?
The man behind me asked me to not recline it while he ate. It's something he brought on the plane. And so I left my seat unreclined for a good 10 minutes.
After he was done with his meal, she says she reclined the seat again. On the tape, if you listen closely, you can hear him asking her, "What's your problem?"
I don't have one.
She was even issued this passenger disturbance notice that reads, "You should immediately cease if you wish to avoid prosecution and your removal from this aircraft."
She said, "I'm not dealing with you anymore," handed me that, and threatened to have me escorted off the plane.
Williams says she has a fused vertebrae that gives her a lot of pain, so she needed to recline her seat.
The guy at least did say, hey, could you move your seat up? And then she did. But because of her fused vertebrae, she had to take the seat back then. She took a selfie video, and that's what the whole world is watching. One more call on this. Brian, you're on WGN. Jump in there, Brian. What do you want to say?
Hi, Captain John. I fly a lot also. I tell you what, it's not the airline's fault. That's the card the guy dealt. He bought that seat. Deal with it. I mean, my wife, she's a flight attendant, and she experiences these things all the time. The best she can do is talk to the lady in front and ask if she can recline her seat later.
And the thing, too, is that they should not have reprimanded her, right? Do we agree on that? I mean, not only is it a bad situation, but they got it wrong. They gave the ticket to the wrong guy. Thanks for the phone call. It's 11:25. Okay, that's that. We could do the airline story all day. I don't think we need to. I think it's been adequately covered. And the conclusion we've come to is that nobody is happy and everybody is pointing the finger at somebody else. Various surveys I see say 79 to 80% of people say the guy is in the wrong for punching the seat in front of him. 20% or so of the people say the lady was the wrong for reclining her seat. If she has fused vertebrae, she should have mentioned that to him. But I was at least impressed with the fact that he said, hey, could you not take your seat back? And she said, I put it up for 10 minutes or so while he, and then she pauses, ate some food that he brought on the plane. Pardon me for micro-psychoanalyzing that, but it didn't sound like a good enough excuse for her. Food he brought on the plane. Okay, fine. What if he just wants his knees to not hurt? Or what if he wants to work with his laptop? Or what if he wants to, I don't know what he wants to do with that little drop-down table, but I know he doesn't want your seat in his chin, and that's what happens. Somebody else told me that there's sort of, I don't exactly understand how this calculation works, but they say that if you're sitting in the normal position and you recline it, you increase your comfort or maybe your space by 10%. You're now coming back, and now you have a little more space available to you. Meanwhile, the compromise to the person behind you is about 50%. They lose a lot more space and comfort than you gain. It's not a win-win or lose-lose. It's a win-lose. You win, they lose. I know you know that, and I know you paid for the ticket, and the guy behind you shouldn't be a jerk. That's why it's the airline's fault. Because some guys are. Judy did want to say something, though. The one guy that called in a moment ago said that the very first call said if that was a guy, it wouldn't have happened that way. Judith, what did you want to say about that?
I think that is very obvious that no man would ever assault another paid passenger while he feels perfectly free to assault a female paid passenger. The airline can quickly and easily put a stop to this type of illegal behavior. Charge the guy. Immediately return the plane to the gate. If it's at the gate, debark him. He has no right to assault another passenger. There's no excuse for it. And there's no excuse for the airline tolerating it. There's no possible excuse for it. Of course, it's for his comfort and convenience. So what? It's for her comfort and convenience, or another male passenger's comfort or convenience, that they recline the seat. You can't excuse that type of behavior.
Judith, have you ever seen the passenger disturbance notice? I didn't know these existed, but evidently they can come around and give you a warning on a piece of paper.
Can I interrupt? I'm sorry to do this, but I don't know, John, if you know, we've been following a story in here, and ABC now says it is reportable that President Trump will commute the sentence of former Governor Rod Blagojevich, who is serving time in a Colorado prison on federal corruption charges. Earlier today, he issued a pardon of Eddie DeBartolo Jr., who is the former owner of the San Francisco 49ers. And about that time, we were getting wind that there may well be several coming today. And ABC News is reporting now that former Governor Blagojevich, serving time in Denver, in Colorado, I should say, may soon be released from prison.
Commute means what?
commute is not a pardon. It means that you will, basically, it's a time to serve situation.
But it does mean he gets out.
I would mean that he gets out and prosecutors wouldn't have an opportunity to try to retry. It's not like his conviction was thrown out and they might retry it. It means that the president will have determined that he time served is sufficient and he will be freed.
Is there any word on why the president is doing this and doing this now?
No, like I said, we heard from the DiBartolo pardon earlier. There are indications there may well be more coming or quite a few coming today. I don't know. The president has certainly been more active, I think, in doing these sorts of things since the impeachment effort to get him removed from office failed. But why it's coming today, I don't know.
Yeah, he sure has been exercising a lot more presidential power since the impeachment process ended. And this has been on his sort of radar. But you didn't know when he said that on Air Force One that he thought that the sentence was extreme and that it was totally unfair. Obviously, they had interacted on his TV show, so he knew of Blagojevich personally and also in the news. I don't know why, though, that he decided to sort of champion the cause of a Democrat governor, but obviously he has. And maybe
think of it this way. I'm sorry, go ahead and complete your thought.
No, I'm done.
Well, you know, he is trying to paint himself as a victim
right.
of the federal prosecutors.
Right.
And in by portraying perhaps Blagojevich as the same way, it would build sympathy for him. Now, you know, the first time he brought this up, he seemed close to pulling the trigger on it and stopped because of the, I don't know if it was unanimous or near unanimous opposition of the Illinois congressional delegation. I remember Congressman LaHood being one of the people who thought this was a bad idea and essentially talked him out of it.
Yeah, no kidding. So his attorney, Mark Vargas, texts and calls me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And Vargas has been in my ear. We've had conversations off the air. And I keep saying, Mark, I don't know that Blago's ever going to get out. But if you can get Patty to come on our show, I'd love to talk about their lives and the possibility and how she was playing Fox News a lot. Remember, Patty has been on Fox News shows. Tucker Carlson, I don't know if she's been on with Sean Hannity, but they've all sort of championed her cause. She's a good guest. She's attractive. It's a celebrated case. And she also plays into the narrative that the Justice Department is a little rogue here. So they all kind of have rallied their, you know, forces around Patty Blagojevich, who they didn't know a thing about. In fact, when they talk about the story, a lot of times they get the details wrong, but they know Patty's their girl and Blago's their guy. And Vargas will call out to me sometimes and say, hey, let's talk a little bit about that. But I said, we really don't have anything to talk about yet. And so I've been texting and calling him now, and he's not picking up for me. So I'd like to know what he knows about how all of this went down as well. But that's a commutation then. It hasn't happened yet, Steve. That's just the early reporting, right? We don't have that confirmed from the White House?
The White House hasn't announced it, but ABC News is saying that they have learned that the president will be commuting this sentence to former Governor Rod Blagojevich. So they are citing several White House officials.
Let me go to my Twitter here and just pop in the president. As you may know, he's active on social media. His tweet 2 hours ago, thank you, MAGA, CAGA 2020, 50% approval rating. Below that, Judge Jackson now has requests for a new trial based on unambiguous, is there something else? You know, he's very busy. He's very interested in Judge Jackson here. The United States cannot and will not become such a difficult place to deal with in terms of foreign countries buying our product, national security, trade. The United States is open for business is another tweet, several of these long tweets in the last couple of hours. The crooked DNC is working overtime to take the Democratic nomination away from Bernie. He loves himself some Bernie these days. These were Mueller prosecutors. He's mad at Mueller. this is just a look into his 4 hours ago. Maybe I still will. This has been a witch hunt. All capital letters. But no mention of he posted the video of that horrific crash The big one at Daytona 500 last night. It was run over the weekend and then postponed because of weather. They ran it last night. And if you've seen the video of that crash, it's really something to see. And the president has retweeted the video of that. But nothing here about Blagojevich.
So the news this morning is that the White House is apparently ready to, ABC reporting that the president will commute the sentence of Rod Blagojevich, who went into prison 6 years almost to the day. It was in March, I think, of 14. He went to prison, March of 2012, I should say, to begin what was then a 14-year sentence. So he will have served 8 years of a 14-year sentence should he be released, should this come to fruition. But again, ABC reporting, and if they come out with this report, I think they've got a great deal of confidence that this is something that's going to happen today.
I have said all along that the sentence was too long. I think it was crazy how long that guy went to jail. Blago should not have gone to jail for as long as Blago went to jail. So then why am I upset that the fact that Blago might get out of jail now? I'm not a big fan of President Trump, and so I need to kind of get my head around that. If President Obama were doing this, I'd be like, that's the power of the presidency. Good job, Barack. Donald Trump does it, and I don't like it. So that's my problem. But if I can divorce myself of either of those feelings and just say, did I think that Blago went to jail for too long? Or here's the question for you right now. Has he served long enough? Well, then that's the only thing that should matter.
I think hasn't Senator Durbin told you that he thought probably it was too long?
You are correct.
So, right. So
and boy, think about that for just a second.
We're chasing down the Republican members of the House here this morning, because they were the ones arguing to have him not released. You've got Senator Durbin saying that he probably had served enough time and perhaps should be released.
What year did he go to jail, Steve? I'm sorry?
2014.
2014. All right. So let me just do the math on this, Steve. 2000, it's 20, right?
Yeah, so that'd be 6 years.
Hold on. I want to do it. So if you take the 20.
I'm sorry. No, March of 2012 he went in.
March of 2012. So 8 years. All right. So then, well, that's a different one then. Hold on just a second. I'll get back to you. So we're looking at about 8 years here, Steve.
I think if you want to be critical, if you want to eat your cake and throw it at someone's face too, if that's what you're reaching for, there's an ulterior motive perhaps in the commutation.
And maybe, okay, and does that matter? Because whatever the motivation is, shouldn't central to that be, is the guy in jail long enough? Was the sentence too long? I said the sentence was too long, and to me, about 8 years is about right. I don't have any sympathy for the Blagojeviches. I'm just trying to measure that against other crimes, against individuals or the state. 8 years sounds about right to me. All right, Aleph, 312-981-7200. You can give us a call, and we'll take some calls on this, Aleph, right? Maybe not. we're doing two things at once here, I know. I'm also looking at Rod's wiki page, just real quick. Rod Blagojevich, born December 10th, 1956, an American politician, served as the 40th governor of Illinois. That's on you, Illinois, from 2003 until his impeachment conviction and removal from office in 2009. A Democrat state representative before being elected to the House.
Remember, he made a big trip overseas to was it Croatia or Serbia? I'm not sure. With Jesse Jackson to win the secure the release of a prisoner there at one point.
And they walked. Jesse did those two people. What was it? Off the plane or off the tarmac with their hands raised, and they were chanting something reminiscent of a Martin Luther King march. I'm trying to remember if it was. It wasn't Free at Last, but maybe it was something like that. It was the epitome of Jesse Jackson, Rod Blagojevich grandstanding, if ever there was.
And that was an early moment for Rod Blagojevich, too.
He was seen as a presidential contender.
Well, we've learned by listening to him that he saw himself in many ways.
Well, but I mean, he wasn't the only one with that pipe dream. He was good-looking. He was from a big... I don't need to sell his resume. At the time, he was a Gary Hart. He was an up-and-comer.
I wouldn't go that far. He was a son-in-law of a very powerful Northwest Side alderman.
Yeah, that helped.
Who won a seat in Congress and was ambitious. And look, he came back and he won governor. That's a big deal.
And he had this thing, and it was golden, and he wasn't going to give it up. Anthony, you're on WGN Radio. Your thoughts? Let's take some phone calls. Go ahead, Anthony. You're on the air.
I'll make it quick. I think the man got railroaded to begin with. And I think Trump did a good thing.
I'm glad you called. Thank you, sir. Joyce, you're on WGN. What about Blago getting out? You're on the air.
Well, I'm okay with him getting out. I think he paid his dues, he learned his lessons, and he's missed all of his children's childhood.
Patty, give us a call. There's two for you. Thank you, Joyce. Mark, you're on WGN. What do you say, Mark? You're on the air.
Well, you can make it three. I agree that he served enough time, but it has to come with a very important caveat that he stay 500 feet away from a microphone or a TV.
Good luck to us on that. Mark, thanks for the call. Mike, WGN Radio, Blago's getting out. What do you say?
Yeah, so my problem is the guy has never admitted any guilt or admitted that he did anything wrong. And if he did, then I would say that he served enough time. But he still has never admitted that.
That's a good point. Thank you for the phone call, Mike. Steve, wasn't that a factor in the sentencing or in the disposition of this case, Blago's inability to tell the judge or anybody else that he was remorseful?
Yeah.
I think that factored into it. Why do you think Chicago is going after Jussie Smollett still? It's because they got their feelings hurt. He didn't say the right things. It's not because of $130,000. Robert, you're on WGN. Jump in there, Robert. What do you want to say?
I don't think he got long enough because I'm against the normalization of corruption. He's trying to make money from a political office in a way that's illegal. Like, he's lucky he's not being put to death for treason like they used to do back in the days, because that's, you know, technically treasonous against our country.
The normalization of corruption in Illinois. Boy, what a brilliant call. Thanks for the thought on that. Jim, you're on WGN. What do you say, Jim? You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wondered... Not sure if I'm for or against the commutation, but there's any figure can be put on what the cost savings to the taxpayers, both federal and state, would be by less mouth. Maybe it's just a political scheme.
He was supposed to serve six more years. What's it about? What's the number? Is it $100,000 a year it takes to incarcerate somebody? So I'll bet you it's over $500,000.
Well, that's the plus side of it. Like I say, I think it's just pay the expert. There's got to be a bright side to it.
Yeah, I guess so. Thanks for the call. Tony, you're on WGN. What do you say, Tony?
Hey, I assume he's a registered felon now, so won't he have trouble getting another job on the outside?
I don't think he'll be able to practice law. I don't think he'll be able, because... Boy, I'm just, thank you for the calls. These are all good questions, and I don't know what the ramifications are of his sentence commutation.
Well, we know he won't get his pension, John.
Can he vote? Can he run for office? Can he practice law in Illinois? I believe all three are still true.
He wasn't pardoned.
Right, that's it.
His sentence was set aside.
So he is still the convicted felon that he was when he went to jail. He's just not in jail anymore. The only thing that's changed is his address. So I think those things that applied when he was in jail are still true today. Sue, you're on WGN. We're talking about Rod Blagojevich, and the word is that the president is going to commute his sentence. What do you say, Sue? Oh, pardon me, Sue.
No,
go ahead, Sue. We missed the first part. What did you say?
I say I couldn't be happier. It's about time.
Thank you for that call. Go ahead, Sue. Okay. Maurice, you're on WGN. Go ahead, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Yeah, I was just wondering, wasn't he offered a plea deal before he went in? If so, would he have been out by now?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, because I don't know what else what would he have given them in a plea agreement that they didn't have. They wanted him. I don't think he was going to offer up his wife. So I'm not sure about that. I'll tell you what, if somebody can fill in that blank for me, Maurice, I'll take that call. Thank you. Bill, you're on WGN. Hi, Bill.
Hey, it's about time they let him out. His four daughters have probably missed him, and I just hope the family can get back together and enjoy the rest of their life.
So the second question then after that is, did you like him going in?
Oh, shoot, we just lost him.
Because I'm just wondering about that, because there are a lot of people say, you know, and I think like you said, there are a lot of people who think he's done enough time who don't necessarily are kind of happy that he did some time.
Yeah, right. I mean, truly, if we had no history here, we just said Rod Blagojevich 8 years ago is going to go to jail for 8 years. I think a lot of people would have felt that that was justice served, but it was 14. Now he's going to get out 6 years early. So therein lies that question. That's, I think, where I'm coming from, Steve. I always thought that the sentence was too long. Linda, you're on the air. What did you say? Hi, Linda.
I just wanted to say I believe with Mike that there should be a caveat.
You know, he never apologized. I think he's an arrogant SOB. But also, you know, if he gets released, I don't think he or his family should receive any compensation for interviews. I don't think it's deserving of anything like that.
Thanks for the phone call. He's already written one book. It's 11:55. Okay, we'll continue to follow this story. We'll pause here. Zsuki is getting ready for the business lunch, and Steve Bertrand and the gang in the WGN Radio Newsroom have more. If you're just joining us, the news from ABC and WGN Radio is that the president is poised to commute the sentence of Rod Blagojevich. Zsuki is down the hall. What are you guys doing today?
We're going to be talking about local startups, and Serena Williams is actually joining a local Chicago startup as an advisor.
Oh, I like the sound of that.